I'm John Strumquist, Executive Director of the Waldo Consortium. It's good to be here with our neighbors to the south from Vail. And this is the a good definition of the material that I'm going to cover. It's clear and concise, but it doesn't really convey the full emotional impact that open source is having on our consortium. So as a subtitle, I would prefer... Might be a good name for the Hollywood movie version of what we're going to do. Just a very quick word of background about Waldo. It is a very necessary, although anachronistic, acronym. It was founded in 1982 as the Westchester Academic Library Directors Organization, a real mouthful. So Waldo comes in handy as a quick way of referring to it. It's a multi-type library consortium. We do have K-12 public specials and academics, although we really focus our efforts on the academic portion of our membership. And I guess Josh would want to refer to us as a buying club. That's often thought of as a pejorative. I have a t-shirt that says Waldo the Buying Club. We're proud of that portion of our activity. Most of our members are in New York. We have about 100% participation among New York academics. More recently in New England, a big participation there. And a number of Vail members are also subscribers to some of the Waldo databases, either through Vail or directly. So we feel like we're among friends here. The membership is a little bit arcane in Waldo. We have 12 members that are referred to as full members. That simply means that they have, in fact, since 1983, shared a common ILS system. We have another 11 members called associate members who are also in the immediate New York metro area that participate in resource sharing arrangements, including a union catalog. So that's the core group. We also have 500 plus academic members that we refer to as just regular members. They're participating in our procurement agreements, as well as 400 public and special members. So it turns out to be a rather large group. What we do, for the most part, everyone has their specialty, is we do negotiate contracts with vendors, publishers, and purveyors of electronic services to libraries. There are 57 vendors out there, 1,600 products, and we make a proud practice of passing through all the volume discounts that we can negotiate. Volume discounts was the original reason that we started doing that. It still is a core value of ours. However, providing services to libraries like a one-stop shopping. I know you all love your database providers and like to see the salesman come by and visit you all the time. But who's got time to talk to 57 people? So we have a one-stop supermarket website. People take advantage of that. We find that anything that can save librarians time is welcome, and almost any product that costs them time to implement is not very successful in the long run. We do this by charging a 5% administrative fee on the overhead, and it's been a successful model for us. We have consistently grown this activity by 25% a year since 2000, so it's gone up a lot. From 1983, now we're really going back and dating myself, until 2004, the full and associate members used an integrated library system called the PAL system. Some of you may be aware of it. It was developed by Mankato State University in Mankato, Minnesota. And it has a large, it's a large factor, I think, in where Waldo is today, because that was essentially an open source forerunner system. It was owned and operated by librarians. This was before an open source licensing agreement was conceived, but we had access to the source code and we could make changes if necessary. And most importantly, we took great comfort in the fact that it was a bunch of librarians running this system. The high point of that from our point of view is when shortly after we started this, the Waldo Executive Board passed a resolution saying that under no circumstances would an ILS system ever be hosted on any one of its members' campuses. So a pox on you, IT. You know, we're going to go on our own and control our own destiny. We were pretty happy with that system. Minnesota state politics intervened, and in 2004, the PAL system essentially went out of business. And so everyone was left to look for an alternative. At that point, we did make a decision that was important, and that was not to follow the traditional procurement process for ILS systems that's so time-honored among librarians, and you're all familiar with it. It's write the biggest RFP you can imagine. Nothing less than 10,000 questions will do. And all these RFPs came from the same place. I think it's a consultant in Chicago somewhere. And the problem with that is that the vendors can lie faster than you can write. And after you have gone through this laborious exercise, and the most egregious example that I know of was in Minnesota, where they had 350 evaluators, and in fact had to draw lots to see who could attend the meeting because there wasn't enough seating capacity. And if you follow what's going on in Minnesota since then, you see it was all to very little avail. The other problem was, of course, that once you've written the RFP and you've made the award and evaluated all of these things, then you sit down and, oh, by the way, what did we forget? Oh, yes, let's make the award, and to the winner we go and negotiate a contract. Guess what? You don't really have maximal leverage when the guy you're sitting across the table from knows he's the winner. So we didn't want to do that. We would probably use a procedure similar to the one you would use if you were going to go out and buy a family automobile. Or alternatively, the one the Gartner Group in Greenwich, Connecticut would recommend to all their Fortune 100 companies. And that is assess the marketplace objectively and subjectively, try to identify the top two or three vendors in terms of market share and success, and then spend your time looking at their products. Nobody's going to write a 10,000 question RFP about a carburetor and a cylinder on a car. Interview the customers. Ask your friends how they like the car you're thinking about buying. And then when you've identified two people, bring them both in and negotiate a contract before you make an award to either one, so that the contract itself is part of the award process. And that's what we did in selecting the alternative to the PAL system, which we've been operating on since 2004. It was a hosted service. That was an easy decision for us to make. Since we've been running on a hosted system for 20 years, we don't know any better than to have a hosted outsourced system. We negotiated a full cost of ownership contract over a 5-year period of time. And then guess what? The company we made the awards to got sold twice and ended up being owned by a private equity company. So here we are. You can only take so many steps to protect yourself. We did, however, have in our contract a provision that at the 3-year point, we could reopen negotiations with the vendor with regard to extensions. You know, never get down to the last 6 months and then decide we better do something. So the deadline for that in our case was August 1st of last year, 2007. So with those midterm negotiations in mind, we said, let's get ready for this extension negotiation, if that's what it's going to turn out to be. But if we're going to go talk to the vendor, we better have some kind of a credible plan in mind as to what to do if we're not happy with what the vendor has to offer us. However, our executive board looks at the alternatives and decided that there's probably not 5% difference between any of the major legacy ILS vendors today in terms of functionality, quality of support. And it was great for us to figure that out, but guess what? The vendors know that too. And they're going to say, these guys aren't going to waste all their time migrating from what I'm going to offer them to another source. There's way too much time and energy involved in that. So that wasn't really an alternative to go to another, I'm going to refer to them as legacy vendors. So what else could be considered? And what about open source? We had talked about open source for a couple of years. You saw from the dates that were in the presentations this morning that until very recently, there really weren't a lot of serious alternatives. The thing that really woke us up to the fact that open source could be an alternative for us, a viable alternative, was what happened with Georgia Pines and its progress. This was definitely something that we had to take seriously. We have an industrial strength system out there pumping millions of transactions every year. We can't afford not to believe there's something to that. Let's try to find out what it is and whether it would fit into our requirements. And we were in pretty much of a hurry at this point, although we still have 2.5 years left on our agreement. We know that we've got a timeline running here. We knew that we basically wanted something that would be no less than the functional equivalent of what we have now. We did have. We wanted to be hosted. We wanted full support. Waldo is a technology adverse organization. You know, we're not trying to be champions of development. We just want things to work so we can sleep nights. Bug fixing was, of course, very important. And applications development, if you think about the open source model at all, you know you have to have access, as was so clearly described this morning, to development resources. That's one of the touchstones here. And we wanted 24/7 help desk. So those were our basic requirements. Let's see what we can find. We appointed a 4-person technical committee. These are the things that consortia always do. I was one of the members. We had two people from the head of our technical committee and two ILS people who were particularly knowledgeable on the subject. And we started making phone calls. And initially, we asked for demonstrations from the two principal providers of this service in North America. That would be from Libline, Koa Zoom, and from Equinox, the Evergreen system. And believe me, after that was probably a changing moment for us. After we had those initial discussions with both of those vendors, and we talked to the Mellon Fund as well, to realize that there really is a lot there. There were stories going around, well, these people don't even have a CERC system, and you know, this is child's play, don't look any further. We were very impressed and decided, or knew at that point, that we had to go further with this investigation. In some cases, the OPAC in particular was deriving a lot more functionality than the system we were currently using. So we decided to go forward. The open source model itself, as has been discussed earlier today, is a big factor in that decision because it gives us a degree of control, that is independence of the future direction that our system will go in that we couldn't find elsewhere, and the ability to collaborate with other of our colleagues and organizations in the library field. Something that wasn't mentioned too much this morning that I think is very important is that open source systems tend to be standards based. And that really accounts for a lot of the rapid development that can take place. We see repeatedly when you go to your vendor and ask them, your legacy vendor, what about compliance with a particular standard? He says, well, it's going to take us 2 years to retrofit that into our older architecture. And those are 2 years that we're paying for a loss of functionality on. So that's an important item. And of course, the fact that these systems are so much younger technology-wise and are capable of this rapid development, you have to be careful what you say to Josh, who we deal with a lot these days, because he usually goes home that night and puts it in the system. And it sounds like an exaggeration, but oftentimes it actually has happened. A key reason was, of course, the vendor lock-in. We don't want vendor lock-in. We want to be able to pick up and move if necessary. We feel that would give us a tremendous advantage, leverage, in terms of what we do and the quality of the relationship that we have with our vendors. And of course, this isn't exactly a one-sided decision. Perhaps the most dangerous thing you can do is do nothing at all, because if you stand pat, you're going to be in an environment that now consists largely of absentee owners. Corporations now own library classical legacy vendors who don't really know anything personally about the library marketplace. There are very troublesome business models here. Consolidation, but what's going to happen after the consolidation? It could only mean reduction of staff and support. We don't see anything really good coming out of that from the customer's point of view. There's the near certainty, and we projected that, and now we feel like our projections have been fulfilled, that there's guaranteed migration if you stay with the vendor you currently have. Most of those consolidations will result in a requirement that you once again migrate to the latest implementation of their system. And of course, there's also the real experience, and this is something that, as we speak to libraries across Waldo land, one of the most common themes is the dissatisfaction that they all feel. And I haven't mentioned the name of the vendor that we currently have, because I don't think it's really important. I think they're all the same in this regard. I wouldn't want to lead anybody off down that blind alley. But people aren't happy with the level of service that they're getting, and they're very openly complaining about it. There's also, what would the case be if, God forbid, we have success syndrome with open source initiatives, and people start actually migrating? What's the shape, position is that going to leave the legacy vendors in? If they start losing 5, 10% of their installed base, it's going to be a much more difficult proposition for them to continue to support their remaining customers. The biggest question that we had, and it's a cultural question as well as a technical question, what about academic library support? For a long time, academic libraries in my part of the neck of the woods have always looked to their friendly neighborhood ARL library to tell them what they should be doing and then try to go emulate that. And who's using open source systems? K through 12s and public libraries. There's definitely a cultural problem here. So a lot of people just don't really take this very seriously. There are a few academic libraries when we looked a year ago, but not a lot. And the vendors who were out there were serving a somewhat different marketplace. But we needed to find out what the specific realities of that situation were. And at that point, looking at our timeline of August of 07, we had to simplify our process, so we made a decision to focus on a single vendor based on the situation that existed at that particular time. And we did pick Koha Zoom for the following reasons. It really, I think, presented the best architectural fit for the Waldo Consortium. The Waldo Consortium is composed of private academic libraries that value their independence and always have guarded it very jealously. There's a lot of discussion about one system versus separate systems. The policy independence and data independence of our members were key variables for us, key determining factors. And I think it's important to realize that we didn't have to sacrifice the advantages of a common data store with all of our records in a union catalog. That is also maintained concurrently. So you really have the best of both possible worlds with this architectural arrangement. And we have enough committee meetings in Waldo now without convening a myriad more trying to hammer out common policies for item classifications, patron clue. Who knows where that might take you if everyone has to agree on that level of detail. We asked LibLine to come up and meet with us more extensively in March. And this is also, I think, important, and it underlines the collaborative aspect of this. The first day, we told them to sit down and be quiet, and we explained to them what academic libraries needed. The second day, we were quiet, and they explained to us what Koha Zoom could do. So now there was an even playing field when you really work collaboratively with your vendor partner. In April and May, because of the results of that, this has been a favorable build all along, we asked LibLine to come back more extensively and spend a concentrated period of time working with six of our libraries that for one reason or another presented a particular challenge in terms of the contents of their collection, the number of branches they had, the sheer size of their staff, etc., and to identify to us and give us a scoping study that would note all of the functional requirements that were necessary to meet our needs, to develop a budget for implementing those requirements, to propose the migration requirements to us, to give us a timeline to make a transition to this system. And from my point of view, being the procurement guy, not the librarian, working with us and negotiating a full contract with all the terms and conditions that they would be ready to sign that would embody all of this. And they did it. And in May and June, they presented us with a scoping study. It's about 250 pages. The executive board got it, took a look at it, and then we gave it to all our participating libraries for their review. The time and cost proposals look very favorable to us. You have to sort of believe in rapid systems development in the new environment. But LibLine was willing to stand behind those deadlines and offered us, just so you don't think we're real heroes, they offered us kind of a walkaway provision. If they couldn't do what they promised us to, we have ways of resolving that in the contract. So with that, armed with that additional security blanket, we surveyed all our members to get specific information that would allow us to put a total dollar cost. The primary requirement that you have to know in order to get a cost estimate on the system is the number of BIB records that you have. There are a few other things, but that's the main item. So we surveyed that, put all that information together, validated a cost proposal. It was easy for us to know the cost of our 12 consortium members because we're paying the bill centrally and charging our members back. But along the way, we collected interest from a number of other Waldo libraries as well. So at this point, we're up to the count of 19 libraries. The other ones were on standalone platforms. We didn't have direct information into their costs, so we had to take the time to validate the costs. And librarians are very sensitive about sharing with you how much they're paying for the system. You probably know why. You're afraid that maybe you're paying too much and don't want anyone to know it. So in many cases, we didn't actually get dollar figures, but we got people to tell us. The library director would say, yeah, we're saving money. And then the systems librarian would say, yeah, we're saving a lot. So we felt good about that. We got final contract terms from LibLime in September of 2007. So you can see the clock is running out. Because of our tradition of negotiating procurement agreements for consortia, we took time to build all of this into our contract. And I'm not going to go through all of this now, just in the interest of time. But there is a handout that's in the front of the auditorium here that highlights all the principal financial advantages that you get out of this contract. And it provides for other groups. We call ourselves the Waldo Full Member Group, but you can have groups from New Hampshire or New Jersey, or individual members. All of that's provided in the structure. And it's driven by volume participation. We get bigger discounts if we have more participation. One other feature that I do want to mention about our contract is the investment that we've made in the project. And Waldo has included a total of about $682,000 of development spread out into three phases. The first phase, there's 20 projects in phase number one. Now underway, we have 50 subject matter experts from the Waldo side working in three development lines with LibLine with a target completion date of August of this year to bring up St. John's University, which is our biggest and most complicated library, at a level of basic functionality. So if they wanted to, they could really just continue running live thereafter. Whether we do or not, we don't know. The rest of the libraries at the last year of our contract will be brought up subsequently to that in a second wave of development. What do I mean by core projects? An example is course reserves. The most often asked question, does your system support course reserves? An example of a secondary kind of project would be implementation of additional support for music collections or for libraries that have call slips rather than circulation. We've also, being conservative, held back $200,000 just in case. You know, this fish doesn't realize the other fish is swimming in the same water. And we've had a couple of those, but they've been very minor at this point. And if the best case obtains, we can use that money for development of an ILL module. And another challenge of working in the open source environment is simply that there's everybody else out there with the same good ideas that you have, and we have to work to coordinate how this development money can be spent so we don't overlap. Waldo's contribution to that effort is we are asking people who use our contract to take full advantage. You're getting the full advantage of all our development, obviously, under the open source model. But we're also asking people to participate and give back some of the volume discount savings. Let's put it into an ongoing, self-sustaining development fund so that we can continue to... I don't think anyone's going to run out of ideas for enhancing the system in the next few months, so, or next few years. So we'll be in good shape. With the level of participation that we foresee, this could very well generate several hundred thousand dollars a year, which goes quite a ways to taking care of things. Much more enjoyable than sitting around processing RFC requests from somebody who never reads them. The development fund is going to be 2/3 for new development, about 1/3 for supporting. Waldo has hired one full-time ILS specialist now, and another one part-time, to help us to do the development in the first case, but later just to help people deal with questions and formulating additional development requests and coordinating all of that. These are the members. There are the core members. The smallest one is Concordia College, 682 FTE. The largest, St. John's University. These are our original members. These are the ones that have come along since then. Sarah Lawrence University, running on a separate platform. The University of Hartford. St. Vladimir's Orthodox Seminary, which has got 14 other seminaries that it's kind of the hub for. So they have their eyes on all of the Russias. So there are 400 in Russia. So we'll see what happens there. So this has been very successful. The libraries in Florida are members of a partner organization of ours who got the Horizon notice and are now migrating to COHA as quickly as they can with the idea of being completely live. They're not even going to wait for our enhancements and are optimistic about that. So we will go forward from this point through the summer doing the beta tests and moving in with the rest of our schedule. And I see that is about as much time as I've got. So thank you for your attention.